You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Bill Radke. Two reports released this month show a decline in opioid prescriptions in states that have legalized medical marijuana. One report looked at Medicaid enrollees, the other people who are on Medicare. Both find that weed can encourage lower prescription opioid use and serve as a harm abatement tool in the opioid crisis. We had a lot of questions about those studies, so we turned to Dr. Andrew Saxon to try to get some of the answers. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington, and he directs the Addiction Psychiatry Residence Program at the university. Welcome to our studios, Dr. Saxon.
Happy to be with you.
First, let's take a closer look at these two reports. One, as I mentioned, looked at Medicaid, the other at Medicare, and they both found some reduction in prescription opioids in states like Washington that have legalized medical marijuana. So how much did these prescriptions go down?
They went down by a few percentage points. So it wasn't a massive reduction, but it was a what we would call a statistically significant reduction. So that means that you would be unlikely to see those reductions by chance alone. It is important to point out that when you're looking at epidemiologic data like these data, we're not looking at the behavior of any individual person. And so we can't say with certainty that the existence of medical marijuana laws and the legal availability of marijuana is what drove down the prescribing of opioids. We can only say with certainty that these two events are associated.
People seemed pretty excited about this, nevertheless.
Well, I think people are excited because at least it opens the door to the potential that medical marijuana might be an intervention that could be used for some people who have chronic pain rather than using opioids. So given the fact that we're in a very serious epidemic where many more people are dying from drug overdoses than from auto accidents or even from suicides, where more people died from overdoses in 1 year than all the Americans who died during the 20 years of the Vietnam War, anything that we can do that might help, we have to try every option.
What was your reaction when you first heard about these results?
My first reaction actually was surprise. After reading them carefully and seeing that the methodology was very sound and that they used statistical controls to examine many other characteristics of the states that do and don't have medical marijuana, and they differ in many, many other ways, as you might imagine. It was sophisticated techniques that were very well done. So I think the data are convincing that this is a real phenomenon that occurs. And again, what we don't know is the absolute cause of it.
The reports were published in the JAMA Internal Medicine Review. That's the Journal of American Medical Association's internal medicine publication. You're saying that there's significance, but that medical marijuana is not a silver bullet when it comes to helping prevent opioid abuse?
So I'm saying that it could have potential as one tool that we could use to deal with this epidemic, but the epidemic is complicated and there are many, many other things that we would need to do. I also should add that we've been relying on medications to help people with chronic pain, and there are medications other than opioids and other than marijuana that can help, but there also are non-medication interventions that can be very potent that are not widely available because, number one, the healthcare system doesn't pay people to provide those, and we haven't trained the workforce to do that.
The University of Washington used to have a pain center, and it was not about prescribing opioids. It really was talking about different kinds of pain relief therapies. And as I understand it, when you talk about the healthcare system, you're talking specifically about insurance reimbursement, right?
Yes.
So does that pain center still exist?
Well, the pain center does still exist. It has altered its characteristics over time, but as it currently exists, the focus is on trying to use therapies that are not opioids and in many cases are not medication. Probably the most potent one is actually a form of psychotherapy called cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's been shown to improve chronic pain in randomized controlled trials. In brief, what it's trying to do is change people's thoughts and attitudes about their pain. And to really explain how that works, I have to go into a little bit about the physiology of pain and the purpose of pain. And so why do we have pain? Why should we have to suffer? Well, we have pain for a very important evolutionary purpose, which is a way for the body to tell our brain when we're doing something that might be dangerous to our survival. And unfortunately, that doesn't always work right, and sometimes there's pain when there is no danger. And that's often the situation with people who have chronic pain, that their body's telling them, you can't move, you can't try things, that would be dangerous, you might even die if you did that. And yet there really is no danger, and actually if they move and they're active, that might end up helping the pain. So one of the things that the cognitive behavioral therapy does is help people change these thoughts and beliefs about their pain to give them the freedom that they have more safety than what these very powerful chemical messages their body and their brain are getting tell them they're not safe. And so that kind of intervention, which can take more time and effort but can be sustained over a long period of time, can be very helpful.
I'm talking with Dr. Andrew Saxon, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington. And as you're describing that, Dr. Saxon, it sounds reasonable, but it also sounds like anathema to our instant gratification culture. We're used to getting a pill, ordering something online, and having it delivered in 2 hours. I mean, that is how our society has been socialized at this point in time. So it would seem that there'd be a lot of resistance from patients to embark in something that would take longer to change behavior, or at least change how they feel about their body's reactions to pain.
I would say that that is accurate, that that might be most people's first reaction. You really want me to spend 8 or 12 weeks of my life working on this problem when I'm pretty sure medication's the only thing that can help me? So we do need to bring people along, and some patients are more willing to do that than others, and most find that they do get some benefit from it.
So to go back to these two studies that we began talking about, basically they're interesting to you, but they're not definitive. Is that fair to say?
Well, they are not definitive in the sense that we can say if we make medical marijuana available to patients, patients will use less opioids. So we'd need a more granular study of actual patients to find that out, which would be actually a challenging study to do. But again, I think it's hopeful that at least in the climate where people have medical marijuana available, the chances that there'd be less opioid prescribing are higher. And well, there also is a study done several years ago showing that the overdose rates were going down in the states that had medical marijuana. So I think there is converging evidence that probably as a harm reduction strategy, making marijuana more readily available might make sense without us saying, gee, that is going to be the solution to this opioid crisis, because it's much more complicated than that. And there's a lot of other interventions that we need to bring to bear to really address the crisis.
Dr. Andrew Saxon, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Washington. He also is director of the Addiction Psychiatry Residency Program at UW. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.